Chapter 13. Looking more barren, inhospitable, and grim than ever. It's like being bewitched, upon my word, I said once to Mr. Burns, from my usual position in the doorway. He was sitting up in his bed place. He was progressing toward the world of living men, if he could hardly have been said to have rejoined it yet. He nodded to me his frail and bony head in a wisely mysterious assent. Oh, yes, I know what you mean, I said. But you cannot expect me to believe that a dead man has the power to put out of joint the meteorology of this part of the world. Though indeed it seems to have gone utterly wrong. The land and sea breezes have got broken up into small pieces. We cannot depend upon them for 5 minutes to jitter. It won't be very long now before I can come up on deck, muttered Mr. Burns, and then we shall see. Whether he meant this for a promise to grapple with supernatural evil, I couldn't tell. At any rate, it wasn't the kind of assistance I needed. On the other hand, I had been living on deck practically night and day so as to take advantage of every chance to get my ship a little more to the southward. The mate, I could see, was extremely weak yet, and not quite rid of his delusion, which to me appeared but a symptom of his disease. At all events, the hopefulness of an invalid was not to be discouraged. I said, "You will be most welcome there, I am sure, Mr. Burns. If you go on improving at this rate, you'll be presently one of the healthiest men in the ship." This pleased him, but his extreme emaciation converted his self-satisfied smile into a ghastly exhibition of long teeth under the red mustache. "Aren't the fellows improving, sir?" he asked soberly, with an extremely sensible expression of anxiety on his face. I answered him only with a vague gesture, and went away from the door. The fact was that disease played with us capriciously very much as the winds did. It would go from one man to another with a lighter or heavier touch, which always left its mark behind, staggering some, knocking others over for a time, leaving this one, returning to another, so that all of them had now an invalidish aspect, and a hunted apprehensive look in their eyes, while Ransom and I, the only two completely untouched, went amongst them assiduously distributing quinine. It was a double fight. The adverse weather held us in front, and the disease pressed on our rear. I must say that the men were very good. The constant toil of trimming yards they faced willingly. But all spring was out of their limbs, and as I looked at them from the poop I could not keep from my mind the dreadful impression that they were moving in poisoned air. Down below, in his cabin, Mr. Burns had advanced so far as not only to be able to sit up, but even to draw up his legs. Clasping them with bony arms, like an animated skeleton, he emitted deep, impatient sighs. "The great thing to do, sir," he would tell me on every occasion, when I gave him the chance, "the great thing is to get the ship past 8°20 of latitude. Once she's past, that we're all right." At first I used only to smile at him, though, God knows, I had not much heart left for smiles. But at last I lost my patience. "Oh, yes. The latitude 8°20. That's where you buried your late captain, isn't it? Then with severity, don't you think, Mr. Burns, it's about time you dropped all that nonsense?" He rolled at me his deep sunken eyes in a glance of invincible obstinacy. But for the rest he only muttered, just loud enough for me to hear, something about odd surprised. ... Play us some beastly trick yet. ... Such passages as this were not exactly wholesome for my resolution. The stress of adversity was beginning to tell on me. At the same time, I felt a contempt for that obscure weakness of my soul. I said to myself disdainfully that it should take much more than that to affect in the smallest degree my fortitude. I didn't know then how soon, and from what unexpected direction it would be attacked. It was the very next day. The sun had risen clear of the southern shoulder of Koh Ring, which still hung, like an evil attendant, on our port quarter. It was intensely hateful to my sight. During the night we had been heading all round the compass, trimming the yards again and again, to what I fear must have been for the most part imaginary puffs of air. Then just about sunrise we got for an hour an inexplicable, steady breeze, right in our teeth. There was no sense in it. It fitted neither with the season of the year, nor with the secular experience of seamen as recorded in books, nor with the aspect of the sky. Only purposeful malevolence could account for it. It sent us traveling at a great pace away from our proper course, and if we had been out on pleasure sailing bent it would have been a delightful breeze, with the awakened sparkle of the sea, with the sense of motion and a feeling of unwonted freshness. Then, all at once, as if disdaining to carry farther the sorry jest, it dropped and died out completely in less than 5 minutes. The ship's head swung where it listed. The stilled sea took on the polish of a steel plate in the calm. I went below, not because I meant to take some rest, but simply because I couldn't bear to look at it just then. The indefatigable Ransom was busy in the saloon. It had become a regular practice with him to give me an informal health report in the morning. He turned away from the sideboard with his usual pleasant, quiet gaze. No shadow rested on his intelligent forehead. "There are a good many of them middling bad this morning, sir," he said in a calm tone. "What? All knocked out?" "Only two actually in their bunks, sir, but it's the last night that has done for them. We have had to pull, and all the blessed time." "I heard, sir. I had a mind to come out and help only, you know." "Dot, certainly not. You mustn't. Dot, the fellows lie at night about the decks too. It isn't good for them." Ransom assented. "But men couldn't be looked after like children. Moreover, one could hardly blame them for trying for such coolness and such air as there was to be found on deck. He himself, of course, knew better. He was, indeed, a reasonable man. Yet it would have been hard to say that the others were not. The last few days had been for us like the ordeal of the fiery furnace. One really couldn't quarrel with their common, imprudent humanity making the best of the moments of relief, when the night brought in the illusion of coolness, and the starlight twinkled through the heavy, dew-laden air. Moreover, most of them were so weakened, that hardly anything could be done without everybody that could totter mustering on the braces. No, it was no use remonstrating with them. But I fully believed that quinine was of very great use indeed. I believed in it. I pinned my faith to it. It would save the men, the ship, break the spell by its medicinal virtue, make time of no account, the weather but a passing worry, and, like a magic powder working against mysterious malefices, see cure the first passage of my first command against the evil powers of calms and pestilence. I looked upon it as more precious than gold, and unlike gold, of which there ever hardly seems to be enough anywhere, the ship had a sufficient store of it. I went in to get it with the purpose of weighing out doses. I stretched my hand with the feeling of a man reaching for an unfailing panacea, took up a fresh bottle, and unrolled the wrapper, noticing as I did so that the ends, both top and bottom, had come unsealed. But why record all the swift steps of the appalling discovery? You have guessed the truth already. There was the wrapper, the bottle, and the white powder inside, some sort of powder. But it wasn't quinine. One look at it was quite enough. I remember that at the very moment of picking up the bottle, before I even dealt with the wrapper, the weight of the object I had in my hand gave me an instant premonition. Quinine is as light as feathers. And my nerves must have been exasperated into an extraordinary sensibility. I let the bottle smash itself on the floor. The stuff, whatever it was, felt gritty under the sole of my shoe. I snatched up the next bottle, and then the next. The weight alone told the tale. One after another they fell, breaking at my feet, not because I threw them down in my dismay, but slipping through my fingers, as if this disclosure were too much for my strength. It is a fact that the very greatness of a mental shock helps one to bear up against it by producing a sort of temporary insensibility. I came out of the stateroom stunned, as if something heavy had dropped on my head. From the other side of the saloon, across the table, Ransom, with a duster in his hand, stared open-mouthed. I don't think that I looked wild. It is quite possible that I appeared to be in a hurry, because I was instinctively hastening up on deck. An example is of training become instinct. The difficulties, the dangers, the problems of a ship at sea must be met on deck. To this fact, as it were of nature, I responded instinctively, which may be taken as a proof that for a moment I must have been robbed of my reason. I was certainly off my balance, a prey to impulse, for at the bottom of the stairs I turned and flung myself at the doorway of Mr. Burns' cabin. The wildness of his aspect checked my mental disorder. He was sitting up in his bunk, his body looking immensely long, his head drooping a little sideways, with affected complacency. He flourished, in his trembling hand, on the end of a forearm no thicker than a walking stick, a shining pair of scissors which he tried before my very eyes to jab at his throat. I was to a certain extent horrified, but it was rather a secondary sort of effect, not really strong enough to make me yell at him in some such manner as colon stop. Dot dot heavens. Dot 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 what are you doing? In reality he was simply overtaxing his returning strength in a shaky attempt to clip off the thick growth of his red beard. A large towel was spread over his lap, and a shower of stiff hairs, like bits of copper wire, was descending on it at every snip of the scissors. He turned to me, his face grotesque beyond the fantasies of mad dreams, one cheek all bushy, as if with a swollen flame, the other denuded and sunken, with the untouched long mustache on that side asserting itself, lonely and fierce. And while he stared thunderstruck, with the gaping scissors on his fingers, I shouted my discovery at him fiendishly, in six words, without comment. I heard the clatter of the scissors escaping from his hand, noted the perilous heave of his whole person over the edge of the bunk after them, and then, returning to my first purpose, pursued my course on the deck. The sparkle of the sea filled my eyes. It was gorgeous and barren, monotonous and without hope under the empty curve of the sky. The sails hung motionless and slack, the very folds of their sagging surfaces moved no more than carved granite. The impetuosity of my advent made the man at the helm start slightly. A block aloft squeaked incomprehensibly, for what on earth could have made it do so? It was a whistling note like a bird's. For a long, long time I faced an empty world, steeped in an infinity of silence, through which the sunshine poured and flowed for some mysterious purpose. Then I heard Ransom's voice at my elbow. I have put Mr. Burns back to bed, sir. You have? Well, sir, he got out, all of a sudden, but when he let go the edge of his bunk he fell down. He isn't light-headed, though, it seems to me. No, I said dully, without looking at Ransom. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.